moved the last small personal possessions to return to their relatives. For these few brief moments, he was alone with his thoughts. But his thoughts were not ones he cared to dwell on. He had supervised the removal of the mutilated bodies and then the gathering of the histories of their order, taken now for safekeeping to the vaults beneath the Illicital Manor House. At his father's suggestion, he had gone through those records, page by page, searching for that small bit of revelation on Safehold's puzzle that they had somehow overlooked. He had found nothing. He shook his head. What difference anyway, he thought bleakly. What difference now what was learned of Safehold? Without a chosen to carry the seed, what was the need to locate the Bloodfire? Still, he had been glad to have something to do, anything to do, that would help take his mind from what he had seen when he found Lauren and the others. He stepped away from the empty cottage, crossed the yard of the compound, and turned down the path leading to the Gardens of Life. All across the Carolan, the flicker of torches burned through the gathering darkness. There were soldiers everywhere. Blackwatch ringed the gardens, and Home Guard, the king's personal corps of elven hunters, patrolled the streets and tree lanes of the city. The elves were understandably frightened by what had happened. When word of the slain chosen had spread, Eventine had acted quickly to reassure his people that they would be protected against a similar fate, though in truth he believed them to be in no immediate danger. The thing that had killed the Chosen had not been after anyone else. The Chosen had been its sole target. Nothing else made sense. Still, it did no harm to take precautions. Such measures would do as much to stem the panic the king could sense building in his people as to safeguard the city. The real damage, of course, had already been done. The tree was dying, and now there would be no rebirth. Once she was dead, the forbidding would fail entirely, and the evil locked within would break free. Once free, it would seek out and destroy every last elf. And with the Elkris gone, what miracle of elven magic could be found to prevent it? Ander paused outside the wall of the gardens. He drew a slow breath to steady himself, forcing down the feeling of helplessness that had been building inside all day, little by little, like some insidious sickness. What in the name of sanity were they to do? Even with the Chosen alive, they had not known where the Bloodfire was to be found. With the forbidding already beginning to crumble, there had never been enough time to search it out. And now, with the Chosen dead... Amberlee. Her name whispered in his mind. Amberlee. Lauren's last words to him had been of her. Perhaps she could help, the red-haired Chosen had suggested. Then the idea had seemed impossible. Now anything at all seemed better than what they had. Ander's mind raced. How could he convince his father that he must consider the possibility that Amberlee might help? How could he convince his father even to talk to him about the girl? He remembered the old king's bitterness and disappointment the day he had learned of Amberlee's betrayal of her trust as a chosen. Ander balanced that against the despair he had seen in his father's face this morning when he had brought him the news of the slaughtered chosen. His decision was easily made. The king was desperate for help from some quarter. With Arion gone into the Serendanon, Ander knew that that help must come from him. And what other help could he give but to suggest to his father that Amberlee must be sought? Elven Prince. The voice came from out of nowhere, startling Ander so that he jumped away from it with a gasp. A shadow slipped from the shelter of the pines that grew close against the walls of the Gardens of Life, darker than the night about it. For an instant Ander stopped breathing altogether, freezing with indecision. Then, as he reached hurriedly for the short sword he wore belted at his waist, the shadow was upon him and a hand lay over his own, an iron grip holding back his arm. "Peace, Ander Elicidal. The voice was soft but commanding. I am no enemy of yours. The shadowy form was that of a man, Ander saw now, a tall man standing well over 7 feet. Black robes were wrapped tightly about his spare, lean frame, and the hood of his traveling cloak was pulled close about his head so that nothing of his face could be seen save for narrow eyes that shone like a cat's. Who are you? The elven prince managed finally. The other's hands lifted and drew back the folds of the hood to reveal the face within. It was craggy and lined, shadowed by a short black beard that framed a wide, unsmiling mouth, and by hair cut shoulder length. The cat's eyes, piercing and dark, stared out from beneath heavy brows knit fiercely above a long, flat nose. Those eyes stared into Ander's, and the elven prince found that he could not look away. Your father would know me, the big man whispered. I am Alanon. Ander stiffened, his face incredulous. Alanon? His head shook slowly. But Alanon is dead. There was sarcasm in the deep voice, and the eyes glinted once more. Do I appear to you to be dead, elven prince? No, I can see. Anders faltered. But it has been more than 50 years. He trailed off as the memories of his father's stories came back to him. The search for the Sword of Shannara, the rescue of Eventine from the camp of the enemy armies, the battle at Tirsis. The defeat of the warlock lord at the hands of the little Veilman Shay Omsford. Through it all, Alanon had been there, lending to the beleaguered peoples of the Four Lands his strength and wisdom. When it was finished and the warlock lord destroyed, Alanon had disappeared entirely. Shay Omsford, it was said, had been the last to see him. There had been rumors afterward that Alanon had come to the Four Lands at other times in other places. But he had not come to the Westland and the elves. None of them had ever expected to see him again. Still, where the druid was concerned, his father had often told him one soon learned to expect the unexpected. Wanderer, historian, philosopher, and mystic, guardian of the races, the last of the ancient druids, the wise men of the new world. Alanon was said to have been all of these. But was this truly Alanon? The question whispered in Ander's mind. The big man stepped close once more. Look closely at me, elven prince, he commanded. You will see that I speak the truth. Ander stared at the dark face, stared deep into the glittering black eyes, and suddenly the doubts were gone. There was no longer any question in his mind. The man who stood before him was Alanon. I want you to take me to see your father. Alanon was speaking again, his voice low and guarded. Choose a path little traveled. I wish to keep my coming a secret. Quickly now, before the sentries come. Ander did not stop to argue. With the druid following as closely as his own shadow, he slipped past the Gardens of Life and hurried on toward the city. Minutes later, they crouched within a gathering of evergreens at one end of the palace grounds, where a small side gate stood chained and locked. Ander drew a ring of keys from his pocket and fitted one into the lock. It turned with a sharp snick, and the lock opened. In seconds, they were inside. Ordinarily, the grounds would have been guarded only by the gate watch. But earlier in the day, following the discovery of the murdered chosen, the body of Wendt had been found under a bush at the edge of the South Gardens, his neck broken. The manner of his death was wholly different from that of the chosen, so as yet there was no reason to believe there was any connection. Still, this latest killing was too close to the king to suit the home guard. Additional security had been moved onto the grounds. Dardan and Roe, the king's personal guards, had taken up watch at the king's door. Ander would not have believed it possible for anyone to reach the manor house from the exterior walls without being seen by the sentries. But somehow, with the druid in the lead, they managed to pass without challenge. Alanon seemed little more than another of the night's shadows, moving soundlessly, always keeping Ander close beside him, until at last they reached the floor-length windows that looked in upon the king's study. There they paused momentarily while the druid listened at the curtained window. Then Alanon gripped the iron entry latch and turned it. The window doors swung silently open, and the druid and elven prince stepped inside. From a reading table still littered with histories, Eventine Elicital rose, staring in disbelief, first at his son, and then at the man who followed him in. "Alanon," he whispered. The druid secured the window doors, drew the curtains carefully back in place, then turned into the candlelight. "After all these years..." Eventine shook his head wonderingly and stepped out from behind the table. Then he saw clearly the big man's face, and disbelief turned to astonishment. "Alanon, you haven't aged. You haven't changed since..." He choked on the words. "How?" "I am who I always was," the druid cut him short. "That is enough to know, King of the Elves." Eventine nodded wordlessly, still dazed by the other's unexpected appearance. Slowly he moved back to the reading table, and the two men took up seats across from one another. Ander stood where he was for an instant, uncertain whether to stay or go. "Sit with us, Elven Prince." Alanon indicated a third chair. Ander sat down quickly, grateful to be included, anxious to hear what would be said. "You know what has happened?" the king addressed Alanon. The druid nodded. "That is why I have come. I sensed a breach in the forbidding. Something imprisoned there has crossed over into this world, something whose power is very great indeed. It was the appearance of this creature." There was the faint sound of footsteps in the hallway beyond the study door, and the druid was on his feet instantly. Then he paused, his face calm, and he looked back at the king. "No one is to know that I am here." Eventine did not question this. He simply nodded, rose from the chair, walked quickly to the door and opened it. Manx sat there on his haunches, his tail wagging slowly, his grizzled muzzle raised toward his master. Eventine walked out into the hallway and found Gale approaching with a tray of tea. The king smiled and took it from him. "I want you to go home now and get some sleep," he ordered. When Gale tried to object, he quickly shook his head. "No arguments. We have a lot to do in the morning. Go home. I'll be all right. Ask Darden and Roe to keep watch until I retire. I wish to see no one." He turned abruptly and re-entered the study, closing the door firmly behind him. Manx had wandered in, sniffed questioningly the stranger he found seated at the reading table, then, apparently satisfied, had dropped down next to the stone fireplace beside them, his muzzle resting comfortably on his paws, his brown eyes closing contentedly. Eventine sat down again. "Was it this creature, then, that killed the Chosen?" he asked, picking up the conversation. The druid nodded. "I believe it to be so. I sensed the danger to the Chosen and came as quickly as I could. Not quickly enough, unfortunately, to save them." Eventine smiled sadly. "The fault lies with me, I'm afraid. I left them unprotected even after I was told the forbidding had begun to fail. But perhaps it makes no difference. Even had they lived, I am not certain the Chosen would have been able to save the Elkris. Nothing of what she showed them of the location of the Bloodfire is recognizable, not even the name she gave them, Safehold. Do you recognize it?" Alanon shook his head no. Our records tell us nothing of Safehold, neither those of my predecessors who ruled, nor those of the Chosen, the king continued. I am faced with an impossible situation. The Elkris is dying. In order to save her, one of the Chosen in service to her now must carry her seed to the Bloodfire, immerse it in the flames, and then return it to the earth so that a rebirth might be possible. I am familiar with the history, the druid interjected. The king flushed. The anger and frustration he had held inside was working its way to the fore. Then consider this. We do not know the location of the Bloodfire. We have no record of the name Safehold, and now the Chosen are all dead. We have no one to bear the Elkris seed. The outcome of all this seems quite inevitable. The Elkris will die, the forbidding will crumble, the evil locked within will be free once more upon the land, and the elves, and very likely all of the races inhabiting the four lands, will be faced with a war that could easily destroy us all. He leaned forward sharply. I am a king. I am that, and nothing more. You are a druid, a sorcerer. If you have any help to offer, then do so. But there is nothing more that I know to do. The druid cocked his head slightly, as if considering the problem. Before coming to see you, Eventine, I went into the Gardens of Life and spoke with the Elkris. The king stared at him incredulously. You spoke with? Perhaps it would be more accurate to say that she spoke with me. Had she not chosen to do so, there would have been no communication between us, of course. But she speaks only to the Chosen, Ander interjected, then fell quickly silent as he saw his father frown in annoyance. My son is correct, Alanon. Eventine turned back to the druid. The Elkris speaks to no one but the Chosen, and seldom to them. She speaks to those who serve her, Alanon replied. Of the elves, only the Chosen do so. But the druids have also served the Elkris, though in a different fashion. In any case, I simply offered myself to her, and she chose to speak with me. What she told me suggests that you are mistaken in your view of matters, in at least one respect. Eventine waited a moment for the druid to continue. He did not. He simply sat there, staring at the elf questioningly. Very well, I will ask it then. The king forced himself to remain calm. In what respect am I mistaken? Before I tell you that, Alanon said, leaning forward, I want you to understand something. I have come to give whatever aid I may, for the evil that is imprisoned within the forbidding threatens all life in the four lands. What aid I offer freely. But there is one condition. I must be free to act in this matter as I see fit. Even though you disapprove, Eventine Elicidal, even then, do you understand? The king hesitated, his blue eyes studying the dark face of the other man, searching for answers that clearly were not to be found there. At last, he nodded. I understand. You may act as you wish in this. The druid sat back, carefully masking any emotion as he faced Ander and the king. First, I believe that I can aid in discovering the location of Safehold. What I was shown of Safehold by the Elkris when we spoke was not familiar to me, as I have said. It was not familiar because it was drawn from her memory of the world at the time of her creation. The Great Wars altered the geography of the old world so completely that her perception of it now is quite faulty. Still, we have the name Safehold. You have told me that the histories of the Elven Kings and those of the Order of the Chosen do not record the name. But there is another place to look. At Perenor, within the Druid's Keep, there are histories devoted entirely to the sciences and mystic phenomena of the Old World. Within those books there may be some mention of the creation of the Elkris and the location of the Bloodfire. This is a distinct possibility, because much of the information contained in those histories was gathered at the time of the First Council of the Druids, drawn from each member as it had been handed down since the Holocaust. Remember, too, that the guiding light of that council was Galifile, and Galifile was an elf. He would have seen to it that something about the creation of the Elkris and the location of the Fountain of the Bloodfire was set down. He paused. Tonight, when we are finished here, I will go on to Perenor. The histories are well hidden to any but the Druids, so it is necessary that I go myself. But I believe that within their pages is recorded some mention of the name Seyfold. From what is written there, we may hope to discover the location of the Bloodfire. He folded his hands on the table's edge and his eyes fixed on those of the king. Now as to the Chosen, Eventine, you are mistaken entirely. They are not all dead. For an instant the room went deathly still. Amberley, Ander thought in astonishment. He means Amberley. All six were killed, Eventine began, then stopped abruptly. There were seven chosen, the Druid said quietly. Seven. The king went rigid, his hands gripping the edges of the table until the knuckles were white. His eyes mirrored anger and disbelief. Amberley. He breathed the name like a curse. The Druid nodded. She is one of the Chosen. No! The king was on his feet, shouting. No, Druid! There was a scurrying of footsteps in the hallway beyond, and then a pounding on the study door. Ander realized what his father had done. His shouts had brought Darden and Roe. Hurriedly, he went to the door and opened it. He was surprised to find not only the guards, but Gael as well. All peered curiously into the study, but the elven prince carefully blocked their view. Then his father was beside him. I told you to go home, Gael, Eventine reprimanded the young elf sternly. Do so now. Gael bowed mechanically, his face showing the hurt he felt at the other man's words, and disappeared back down the hallway without a word. The king nodded to the elven hunters, reassuring them that he was all right, and they returned to their watch. The king stood silently in the open entry a moment, then closed the door. The penetrating blue eyes swept past his son to Alanon. How did you find out about Amberley? When the Elkris spoke with me, she told me that seven had been chosen to serve. One was a young girl. Her name was Amberley Elicidal. The Druid paused, studying carefully the face of the Elven King. It was lined with bitterness. All of its color had drained away. It is unusual for a young woman to be selected as a chosen, Alanon continued calmly. There have been no more than a handful, I think. Not another in the last 500 years. The king shook his head angrily. Amberley's selection was an honor that meant nothing to her. She spurned that honor. She shamed her people and her family. She is no longer one of the chosen. She is no longer a citizen of this land. She is an outcast by her own choice. Alanon came to his feet swiftly, his face suddenly hard. She is your granddaughter, and you speak as a fool would. Eventine stiffened at the rebuke, but held his tongue. The Druid came up to him. Hear me. Amberlee is a chosen. It is true that she did not serve the Elkriss as did the others. It is true that she forsook her duty as a chosen. It is true that for reasons known only to herself, she left Arbalon and the Westland, her home, despite the responsibilities that were clearly hers, that she disgraced her family and particularly you as king in the eyes of her people. It is true that she has made herself an outcast. It is true that she does not believe herself to be one of the chosen any longer. But know this. It is not for you nor for her people to take from her what the Elkriss has given. It is not even for her to do that. It is for the Elkriss alone. Until the Elkriss says differently, Amberlee remains a chosen in her service, a chosen whom may bear her seed in search of the bloodfire, a chosen who may give her new life. Alanon paused. A king may not understand all things, even Tyne Elicidal, even though he be a king. Some things you must simply accept. Eventine stared at the druid without speaking, the anger gone now from his eyes, replaced with hurt and confusion. I was close to her once, he said finally. After her father, my son Anne, died, I became her father. She was still a child, only 5. In the evenings we would play together. He stopped, unable to continue. He took a deep breath to steady himself. There was a quality about her that I have not since found. A sweetness, an innocence, a loving. I am an old man speaking these words about his grandchild, but I do not speak blindly. I knew her. Alanon said nothing. The king moved back to his chair and slowly seated himself once more. The histories record no other woman selected to serve as a chosen since the time of Gerald Shannara. Amberlee was the first in more than 500 years. It was an honor others would have given anything for. He shook his head wonderingly. Yet Amberlee walked away from it. She gave no explanation. Not to me, not to her mother, not to anyone. Not one word. She just left. He trailed off helplessly. Alanon sat down across from him again, his dark eyes intense. She must be brought back. She is the only hope that the elven people have. Father, Ander spoke before he had time to think better of it. Impulsively he knelt next to the old man. Father, on the night before he was killed, Lauren told me something. He told me that the Elkriss had spoken with Amberlee many times after her choosing. That had never happened before. Perhaps Amberlee is our best hope. The king looked at him blankly, as if the words he had spoken meant nothing. Then he placed his hands flat against the worn surface of the reading table and nodded once. I find that hope a slim one, Ander. Our people may accept her back again, if only because they have need of her. I am not altogether certain of this. What she has done by her rejection is unpardonable in their eyes. And perhaps the Elkriss, too, may accept her both as a chosen and as a bearer of her seed. I don't pretend to have answers to those questions, nor do my own feelings matter in this. He turned again to Alanon. It is Amberlee herself who will stand against us, druid. When she left this land, she left it forever. She believed strongly that it must be so. Something made her believe. You do not know her as I do. She will never return." Al-Anon's expression did not change. "That remains to be seen. We must at least ask her." "I do not know where she is." The king's voice turned suddenly bitter. "I doubt that anyone does." The druid carefully poured a measure of the herb tea and handed it to the king. "I do." Eventine stared at him wordlessly for a moment. His face clouded with conflicting emotions, and there were sudden tears in his eyes, tears that were gone as fast as they had come. "I should have guessed," he said finally. He rose, then stepped away from the table several paces, his face partially turned into the shadows. "You are free to act in this as you will, Al-Anon. You already know that." Al-Anon rose with him. Then, to Anders' surprise, he said, "I will require the services of your son for a brief time before I leave." Eventine did not turn. "As you wish. Remember, no one is to know that I have been here." The king nodded. "No one shall." A moment later the druid was through the curtained windows and gone. Ander stood looking at his father hesitantly, then moved to follow. He knew the old man's thoughts now were of Amberley. In the blackness of the Westland forests north of the Carolan, the Dagda Moor sat quietly, his eyes closed. When they opened again, they were bright with satisfaction. The changeling had served him well. He rose slowly, the staff of power flaring sharply as his hands closed about its polished wood. "Druid," he hissed softly, "I know of you." He motioned the formless shadow that was the Reaper, and the monster rose up out of the night. The Dagda Moor looked eastward. He would wait for the druid at Perenor. But not alone. He could sense the druid's power, and he was wary of it. The Reaper might be strong enough to stand against such power, but he had better use for the Reaper. No other help would be necessary. He would bring a handful of the brethren through the eroding wall of the forbidding. Enough to snare the druid. Enough to kill him. Chapter 6. Al-Anon was waiting for Ander when he stepped from the lighted study, and together they retraced their steps across the palace grounds and through the small side gate to the roadway beyond. Then Al-Anon asked to be taken to the stables. Wordlessly, the two followed a back trail that took them through a small stretch of forest to the stable paddocks, and from there to the stable entry. Ander dismissed the old stableman with a word of assurance, and Al-Anon and he stepped inside. Oil lamps lit a double row of stalls, and the soft wicker of horses sounded in the stillness. Slowly Al-Anon passed down the line of stalls, eyes shifting from horse to horse as he walked to the end of the first row and started back up the second. Ander trailed after him and watched. Finally the druid stopped and turned back to Ander. "That one," he pointed. "I'll need the use of him." Ander glanced uneasily at the horse Al-Anon had chosen. The horse was called Artak, a huge coal-black stallion standing fully 18 hands high. Artak was big enough and strong enough to carry someone of Al-Anon's size, and he could withstand a great deal of punishment. He was a hunting horse built for stamina rather than for speed. Yet Ander knew him to be capable of great speed over short distances. His head was narrow and rather small, particularly when viewed in comparison to his great, barrel-chested body. He had eyes that were set rather wide and colored a startling azure. There was intelligence in those eyes. Artak was not a horse that could be mastered by just any man. Indeed, that was exactly the problem. Artak was strong-willed and thoroughly unpredictable. He enjoyed playing games with his riders, games that usually ended with the riders being thrown. More than a few had been injured in those falls. If the man riding Artak was not strong enough and quick enough to prevent it, Artak would find a way to shake him off within seconds after he was mounted. Few men bothered to chance this. Even the king seldom rode him any more, though once he had been a favorite. "There are others," Ander suggested hesitantly, but Alanon was already shaking his head no. "This horse will do. What is his name?"
"Artak," the elven prince replied.
Alanon studied the horse carefully for a time, then lifted the stall latch and stepped inside. Ander moved over to watch. The druid stood quietly before the big black, then lifted his hand in invitation. To Ander's surprise, Artak came over. Alanon stroked the satin neck slowly, gently, and he bent forward to whisper in the horse's ear. Then he fitted a halter to the black and led him from his stall down the walkway to where the tack was stored. Ander shook his head and followed after. The druid selected a saddle and bridle and strapped them snugly in place after removing the halter. With a final word of encouragement, he swung up upon the horse's back. Ander held his breath. Slowly Alanon walked the black down one row of stalls and back along the other. Artak was obedient and responsive. There would be no games played with this man. Alanon brought him back to where Ander stood waiting and stepped down. "When I am gone, Elven Prince," he said, his black eyes fixed on Ander, "I entrust to you the care of your father. Be certain that no harm comes to him." He paused. "I depend on you in this." Ander nodded, pleased that Alanon would show this kind of confidence in him. The druid studied him a moment longer, then turned away. With the elven prince following once more, he walked Artak to the rear of the stable and pushed ajar the wide double doors. "Goodbye, then, Ander Elicidal," he offered and remounted. Easing Artak through the open doors, he rode swiftly away into the darkness. Ander watched after him until he was out of sight. For the remainder of that night, and for the better part of the 3 days that followed, Alanon rode Artak eastward toward Paranor. His journey took him through the deep forests of the Westland to the mouth of the historic Valley of Wrenn, and from there onto the sprawling emptiness of the Strelaheim Plains. He traveled steadily, pausing only to rest, feed, and water Artak, carefully keeping within covered areas of the land, where possible, steering wide of caravan routes and well-traveled roadways. As yet, no one but the elven king and his son knew that he had returned to the Four Lands. No one but they knew of the druid histories at Paranor, or of the Seventh Chosen. If the evil that had broken through the forbidding were to discover any of this, his quest would be seriously threatened. Secrecy was his greatest ally, and he intended that it might remain so. At sunset on the second day of travel, he arrived at Paranor. He was certain that he had not been followed. While still some distance from the ancient fortress, he left Artak in a small grove of spruce where there was good grass and water, and proceeded the rest of the way on foot. It was not as it had been in the time of the warlock lord. The packs of wolves that had prowled the surrounding forests were no more. The barrier of poison thorns that had walled away the keep was gone. The woodlands were quiet and peaceful in the early evening dusk, filled with the pleasant sounds of nightfall. Within minutes he stood at the foot of the druid's keep. The aged castle sat atop a great mass of rock, rising above the forest trees as if it had been thrust from out of the bowels of the earth by some giant's hand. It was a breathtaking vision from a child's fairy tale, a dazzling maze of towers and walls, spires and parapets, their weathered white stones etched starkly against the deep blue of the night sky.
Alanon paused. The history of Perenor was the history of the Druids, the history of his forebears. It began 1,000 years after the great wars all but annihilated the race of man and changed forever the face of the old world. It began after years of desolation and savagery as the survivors of the Holocaust struggled to subsist in a lethal new world where man was no longer the dominant species. It began after the one race of man became reborn into the new races of men, dwarves, gnomes, and trolls. After the elves reappeared. It began at Perenor, where the first council of the Druids came together in a desperate effort to save the new world from total anarchy. Galifile called them here. Galifile, who was the greatest of the Druids. Here the histories of the old world, written and spoken, were set down in the Druid records to be preserved for all the generations of man yet to come. Here the mysteries of the old sciences were explored, the fragments patched together, the secrets of a few restored to knowledge. For hundreds of years the Druids lived and worked at Perenor, the wise men of the new world seeking to rebuild what had been lost. But their efforts failed. One among them fell victim to ambition and ill-advised impatience, tampering with power so great and so evil that in the end it consumed him entirely. His name was Brona. In the first war of the races, he led an army of men against the other races, seeking to gain mastery over the four lands. The Druids crushed this insurrection and drove him into hiding. They believed him dead. But 500 years later he returned, Brona no longer, but the warlock lord. He trapped the unsuspecting Druids within their keep and slaughtered them to a man, all save one. That one was Bremen, Alanon's father. Bremen forged an enchanted sword and gave it to the elven king Gerald Shannara, a talisman that the warlock lord could not stand against. It won for the elves and their allies the second war of the races and drove the warlock lord again from the world of men. When Bremen died, Alanon became the last of the Druids. He sealed the keep forever. Perenor became history to the races, a monument of another time, a time of great men and still greater deeds. The Druid shook his head. All that was past now. His concern must be only with the present. He began to skirt the stone base of the castle, his eyes studying the deep crevices and jagged outcroppings. Finally, he stopped, his hands reaching to the rock and touching. A portion of the stone swung inward, revealing a cleverly concealed passageway. The Druid slipped quickly through the narrow opening, and the stone sealed itself behind him. There was total blackness within. Alanon's hands searched until they found a cluster of wall torches set in iron brackets hammered into the rock. Lifting one free, he worked with the flint and stone he carried in a pouch at his waist until a spark ignited the pitch that coated the torch head. Holding the burning brand before him, he allowed his eyes a moment to adjust. A passage stretched away before him, the faint outline of rough-hewn steps cut into the rock floor, disappearing upward into darkness. He began to climb. The smell of dust and stale air filled his nostrils, and he wrinkled his nose in distaste. The caverns were cold, their chill sealed in permanently by tons of rock. The Druid pulled his heavy cloak about him. Hundreds of steps passed beneath his feet, and still the tunnel twisted through the black. It ended finally at a massive wooden door. Alanon paused and bent close, his eyes studying the heavy iron bindings. After a moment, his fingers touched a combination of metal studs and the door swung open. he stepped through. He stood in the furnace of the keep. It was a round, cavernous chamber that consisted wholly of a narrow walkway encircling a great dark pit. A low iron railing rimmed the pit at its edge. About the walkway, a succession of wooden and iron-bound doors were set into the chamber wall, all closed and barred. The druid moved to the railing and, holding the torch before him, peered downward into the pit. The faint illumination of the fire danced off blackened walls, crusted over with ash and rust. The furnace was cold now. The machinery that once pumped heat to the towers and halls of the castle, locked and silent. But far below, beyond the pale glimmer of the torchlight, beneath massive iron dampers, the natural fires of the earth still burned. Even now, their stirrings could be felt. He remembered another time. More than 50 years ago, he had come to Paranor and the Druid's Keep with the little company of friends from the dwarf village of Cullhaven, the Ohmsfords, Shay and Flick, Balinor Buckhanna, Prince of Callahorn, Menyon, Prince of Lee, Durin and Dale Elicidal, and the valiant dwarf Hendel. He had come in search of the legendary Sword of Shannara, for the warlock lord had returned to the Four Lands, and only the power of the sword could vanquish him. Alanon had come with his little band into the keep and very nearly had not come out again. In this very room he had battled to the death with one of the Skullbearers. The warlock lord had known he was coming. It had been a trap. His eyes lifted sharply, and he listened to the deep silence. A trap. The word disturbed him. It triggered some instinct, a sixth sense of warning. There was something wrong. Something. He stood there for a moment, indecisive. Then he shook his head. He was being foolish. It was the memory. Nothing more. Carrying the torch before him, he moved along the walkway until he reached a tight spiral stairway that led upward. Without a backward glance to the pit or the furnace chamber, he climbed the stairs quickly and entered the upper halls of the Druid's Keep. All was as it had been 50 years earlier. Starlight filtered through high windows in thin ribbons of silver, touching softly the heavy wooden panels and polished timbers that framed up the towering corridor. Paintings and tapestries hung the length of the hall, their rich colors muted into grays and deep blues by the nightfall. Statues of stone and iron stood silent watch before massive wooden doors with handles of brass. Dust lay over everything. A thick, soft carpet and long streamers of cobweb fell from ceiling to marble floor. Alanon moved down the hallway slowly, the torchlight burning through the haze of musty air that hung motionless through the keep. All was silence, deep and penetrating. His footfalls echoed eerily as he walked, and small puffs of dust rose in the air behind him, stirred by the passing of his feet. Doors came and went to either side, all closed, their metal fittings glinting fire as the torchlight struck the mirrored surface. The hall he traveled intersected another, and he turned right. He walked almost to its end, stopping finally before a smallish door of white oak and iron. A huge lock secured this door. The druid fumbled for a moment at the pouch about his waist, finally producing a large metal key. He placed the key in the lock and turned it twice. The mechanism creaked in protest, its workings rusty with disuse, but the heavy bolt drew back. The iron handle slipped free of its catch. Alanon stepped inside and closed the door behind him. The room he had entered was small and windowless. It had once been a study. Shelves of fraying, cloth-bound books lined its four walls, the colors of the bindings long since faded, the pages dried almost to dust. Against the far wall were placed two small reading tables with chairs constructed of reed and cane, stiff and solitary, like sentries at attention. Closer to the doorway were two more comfortable-looking armchairs formed of thickly padded leather. An aged hand-woven rug lay loosely across wooden plank flooring, hammered down with iron nails. The fabric of the rug was laced with heraldic designs and bits of gold leaf. The druid glanced about the room perfunctorily and moved to the wall on his left. Reaching behind the books at the end of the third shelf down, he located two large iron studs. When he touched these, a section of the bookcase swung silently ajar. He pushed the shelving out a bit to allow himself room to pass through, then pulled the casing closed behind him. He stood within a vault constructed entirely of massive granite blocks cut to interlock with one another and then tightly sealed with mortar. Except for a single long wooden table and half a dozen high-backed chairs, the chamber was bare. There were no windows and no door save the one through which he had entered. The air here was stale with age, but breathable. Not surprisingly, given the chamber's tight construction, there was an almost total absence of dust. Using the torch he carried, Al-Anon lit torches bracketed in the wall to either side of the entry and two squat candles that rested on the table. Once that was done, he moved to the wall to the right of the door and began running his hands lightly over the smooth stone. After a moment, he placed the tips of his fingers and thumbs firmly in place against the granite, bridging both palms out, and lowered his head in concentration. At first, nothing happened, but then suddenly a deep blue glow began to spread outward from his fingers and ran through the stone like veins through flesh. An instant later, the wall erupted in soundless blue fire. Then both wall and fire were gone. Al-Anon stepped back. Where the granite wall had been stood row upon row of massive leather-bound books elaborately engraved with gold. It was for this that the druid had come to Paranor, for these were the histories of the druids, the whole of the knowledge of the old and new world salvaged from the holocaust of the great wars, recorded from the time of the first council of the druids to the present. Al-Anon reached up and carefully removed one of the heavy tomes. It was in good condition, the leather soft and pliable, the edges of the pages sharp, the binding solid. They had weathered the ages well. 5 centuries earlier, after the death of Bremen, after he had come to the realization that he was the last of the druids, he had constructed this vault to protect these histories so that they might be preserved for the generations of men and women who would one day live upon this earth and would have need of the knowledge the books contained. From time to time he returned to the keep, dutifully recording what he had learned in his travels about the four lands, setting down the secrets of the ages that might otherwise be lost. Much of what was recorded here dealt with the secrets of sorcery, with power that no one, be he druid or ordinary man, could hope to comprehend fully, much less put to practical use. The druids had thought to keep those secrets safe from men who might use them foolishly. Yet the druids were gone now, save for Al-Anon, and one day he too would be gone. Who then would inherit the secrets of power? It was a matter of no small concern to Al-Anon, a dilemma for which as yet he had found no agreeable solution. He leafed quickly through the book he held and placed it back again, selecting another. He glanced at this second book, then moved to the long table and seated himself. Slowly, he began to read. For nearly 3 hours he did not stir, other than to turn the pages of the history, his face bent close to the carefully inscribed writing. At the end of the first hour he discovered the location of Safehold, but he continued to read. He was looking for something more. At last his eyes lifted and he leaned back wearily. For a time he just sat there in the high-backed chair, staring fixedly at the rows of books that comprised the Druid histories. He had found all that he had been looking for, and wished that he had not. He thought back to his meeting with Eventine Elicidal 2 days earlier. He had told the Elven King that he had gone first to the Gardens of Life, and that the Elkris had spoken with him. But he had not told the king all that she had revealed. In part he had not done so because much of what she had shown had been confusing and unclear, her memories of a time and a life long gone altered beyond anyone's recognition. But there had been one thing that she had shown him that he had understood all too well. Yet it had been so incredible that he felt he could not accept it without first checking the Druid histories. This he had done. Now he knew it to be true, and knew it must be kept hidden, from Eventine, from everyone. He experienced a sense of despair. It was as it had been 50 years ago with young Shay Omsford. The truth must be left to reveal itself through an inexorable passage of events. It was not for him to decide the time and the place of its revelation. It was not for him to tamper with the natural order of things. Yet he questioned this decision. Alone with the ghosts of his ancestors, the last of his kind, he questioned this decision. He had chosen to conceal the truth from Shay Omsford, indeed from all who had comprised the little company of adventurers from Cullhaven, all who had risked their lives in search of the Sword of Shannara, because he had convinced them that they must. But most especially from Shay. In the end he had come to believe that he had been wrong to do so. Was he wrong now as well? This time, should he not be candid from the beginning? Still lost in thought, he closed the book in front of him, rose from the table, and carried the heavy volume back to the niche from which he had taken it. He made a quick, circular motion of one hand before the bank of histories, and the granite wall was restored. He stared absently at it for a moment, then turned away. Retrieving the torch he had brought with him into the keep, he extinguished the vault's remaining lights and triggered the release on the concealed door. Within the druid study once more, he paused long enough to close the open section of shelving so that all was as it had been. He looked about the little room almost sadly. The castle of the druids had become a tomb. It had the smell and taste of death in it. Once it had been a place of learning, of vision. But no more. There was no longer a place for the living within these walls. He frowned his displeasure. His attitude had soured considerably since reading the pages of the Druid history. He was anxious to be gone from Paranor. It was a place of ill fortune, and he, in chief, must bear that ill fortune to others. Silently he walked to the study door, pulled it open, and stepped through into the main hallway. Not 20 feet beyond stood the humped form of the Dagda Mor. Alanon froze. The demon waited alone, his hard gaze fixed upon the druid, the staff of power cradled loosely in his arms. The harsh sound of his breathing cut sharply through the deep silence, but he did not speak a word. He simply stood there, studying carefully the man he had come to destroy. The druid stepped away from the study door, moving cautiously to the center of the corridor, his eyes sweeping the hazy blackness about him. Almost immediately he saw that there were others. Vague, wraith-like forms that crept from out of the shadows on four limbs, their eyes slits of green fire. There were many, and they were all around him. They edged steadily closer, circling slightly from side to side in the manner of wolves gathered about some cornered prey. A low mewling sound came from their faceless heads, a horrible cat-like whining that seemed to find pleasure in the anticipation of what was to come. A few slipped into the pale fringes of his torchlight. They were grotesque creatures, their bodies a sinuous mass of gray hair, their limbs bent and vaguely human, their multiple fingers grown to claws. Faces lifted toward the druid, faces that turned him cold. They were the faces of women, their features twisted with savagery. Their mouths had become the jaws of monstrous cats. He knew them now, though they had not walked the earth for thousands of years. They had been shut behind the wall of the forbidding since the dawn of man, but their legend was written in the history of the old world. They were creatures who lived on human flesh. Born of madness, their bloodlust drove them beyond reason, beyond sanity. They were furies. Al-Anon watched them circle, creeping about the edges of his torchlight, savoring the prospect of his death. It was a death that seemed assured. There were too many for the druid, he knew that already. His power was not great enough to stop them all. They would attack as one, lunging at him from all sides, tearing and ripping him until nothing remained. He glanced quickly to the Dagda Moor. The demon remained where he was, beyond the circle of his minions, his dark gaze fixed on the druid. It was obvious he felt no need to bring his own power to bear. The furies would be enough. The druid was trapped and hopelessly outnumbered. He would struggle, of course, but in the end, he would die. The mewling of the furies rose sharply, a dry wailing that reverberated the length of the keep, echoing hollow and shrill through the castle of stone. Clawed fingers raked the marble floor like the scraping of shattered bone, and the whole of Perrinor seemed to freeze in horror. Then, without warning, Al-Anon simply disappeared. It happened so abruptly that for an instant the bewildered furies ceased all movement and stared in disbelief at the spot where the druid had stood just one moment earlier, their cries dying into stillness. The torch still hung suspended in the haze of darkness, a beacon of fire that held them spellbound. Then it dropped to the floor of the hall in a shower of sparks. The flame disintegrated and the corridor was plunged into blackness. The illusion lasted only seconds, but it was long enough to permit Al-Anon to escape the circle of death that had ensnared him. Instantly he was through the furies and racing toward a pair of massive oaken doors that stood closed and barred at the near end of the hall. The Dagda Moor shrieked in anger, and the staff of power came up. Red fire blazed the length of the corridor, scattering the maddened furies as it arced toward the fleeing druid. But Al-Anon was too quick. With a sweep, his cloak came up, deflecting the attack. The staff's fire shot past him and burst apart the double doors, tearing them from their iron bindings and leaving them shattered. The druid leaped through the entryway into the room beyond and was lost in the darkness. Already the furies were after him, bounding down the hallway like animals, their cries thick with hunger. The fleetest among them surged through the gaping doorway and caught the druid as he struggled to free the clasp that secured a floor-length window leading to the battlements. Al-Anon turned to face them, his tall form crouching. He seized the two closest to him as they leaped for his throat and threw them into the rest. His hands came up and blue fire scattered from his fingers, turning the floor between them into a wall of flame. Still the Furies came after him. The nearest hurtled recklessly into the flames and perished. When the fire vanished a moment later, the windows stood open and the druid was gone. 1,000 feet above the canopy of the surrounding forest land, his back pressed against the towering wall of the druid's keep, Alanon edged his way along a narrow stone ledge that dropped away into blackness. With each step he took, the wind threatened to tear him loose. He worked his way quickly to a slender stone catwalk that bridged to an adjoining tower. The catwalk was less than 3 feet wide. Below, there was only emptiness. The druid did not hesitate. This was his only chance to escape. He started across. Behind him, he heard the screams of rage and frustration that burst from the throats of the Furies as they followed him through the open windows. They came after him in a rush, more sure than he on the smooth castle stone, their clawed limbs gripping tightly as they raced to catch him. At the windows, the Dagdemore raised the staff of power once more, and the killing fire streaked toward the fleeing druid. But Alanon had seen that he would not cross before the Furies reached him. Dropping to one knee, he brought both arms up in a wide circle, and a shield of blue fire materialized in front of him. The flame from the demon's staff shattered harmlessly against it. Yet the force of the attack threw the druid backward, and he tumbled down upon the narrow bridge. In the next instant, the foremost of his pursuers were upon him. This time, Alanon was not quick enough. Clawed fingers ripped through the fabric of his cloak and tore into his flesh. Searing pain racked his shoulders and chest. With a tremendous heave, he threw back the Furies that held him, and they fell from the narrow arch, screaming. Staggering to his feet, he lurched toward the waiting tower. Again the Furies came at him, stumbling over one another in their eagerness to reach their prey, howling their frustration. Their strange, half-woman faces twisted with hate. Again the druid threw them back, his body shredded further, his clothing soaked with blood. Then at last he reached the far end of the bridge, his body sagging against the wall of the tower. He turned, hands raising. Blue fire erupted downward into the stone walk, shattering it apart. With a shudder, the whole of the arch collapsed. Shrieking with horror, the Furies tumbled down into the night and disappeared. Fire from the staff of power flared all about him, yet the druid managed to evade it, dodging quickly around the circle of the tower wall until he was beyond the demon's sight. There he found a small iron door, closed and locked. With a single powerful shove of one shoulder, he burst through the door and was gone.
Chapter 7. It was mid-morning. In the village of the healers, the tiny gnome community of Storlock, the thunderstorm was finally ending. It had been spectacular while it had lasted. Masses of rolling black clouds streaked with wicked flashes of lightning and punctuated by long, booming claps of thunder, torrential rains that hammered the forest land with the force of winter sleet, winds that uprooted whole trees and stripped roofs from the low stone and plaster buildings that comprised the village. The storm had blown out of the Rab Plains at dawn, and now it was drifting eastward toward the dark ridge of the Wolfstag, leaving the woodlands of the Central Anar sodden and muddied with its passing. Will Ohmsford stood alone on the porch of the store rest center, the major treatment facility for the community, and watched absently as the rain slowed to a thin trickle. The clouds still screened away the sunlight, leaving the day wrapped in somber tones of gray, and a fine mist had formed in the mix of cool storm air and warm earth. The eaves and walls of the center were wet and shiny.
The droplets of moisture clung to the leaves of the vines that grew about them, glistening with green freshness. Bits of wood littered the ground, forming small dams against the rivers of surface water that flowed everywhere. The veilman yawned and stretched wearily. He had been up all night, working with children afflicted by a particularly nasty fever that dried away the fluids of the body and sent temperatures soaring. He could have asked to have been relieved earlier, of course, but he would not have felt comfortable doing that. He was still a student among the stores, and he was very conscious of the fact that he must continue to prove himself if he were to one day become a healer. So he had stayed with the children all yesterday, all night, until at last the fever had broken. Now he was too tired to sleep, too keyed up from his night's work. Besides, he knew he should spend some time with Flick. He grinned in spite of his exhaustion. Old Uncle Flick would very likely drag him bodily from his bed if he failed to visit for at least a few minutes before trundling off to sleep. He swung down off the porch, the muddied earth sucking at his boots as he plodded through the damp, head lowered. He was not very big, an inch or two taller than Flick, perhaps, and his build was slight. He had his grandfather's halfling elven features. The slim nose and jaw, the slightly pointed ears hidden beneath locks of blondish hair, the narrow eyebrows that angled up sharply from the bridge of his nose. Distinctive features, they had marked Shay Ohmsford, and now they marked his grandson as well. The sound of running footsteps brought him about. It was one of the servers, gnome aides to the stores. He came up to Will, wizened yellow face streaked with rain, forest cloak wrapped close to ward off the weather.
"Sir, your uncle has been asking for you all night," he panted, slowing. "He insisted I ask after you."
Will nodded understandingly and reached out to clasp the gnome's shoulder.
"I am on my way to see him now. Thank you."
The server turned and darted back through the mist to whatever shelter he had been forced from. Will watched him disappear from view, then started back up the roadway. A smile creased his face.
Poor Uncle Flick.
He would not be here at all if Shay had not taken ill. Flick cared little for the Eastland, a country he could live without quite nicely, as he was fond of reminding Will. He particularly disliked gnomes, though the stores were decent enough folk. Too many gnomes had tried to do away with him in the past, particularly during the search for the Sword of Shannara. That was not something he could forget easily. Such memories lingered on and could not be put aside simply for the sake of being fair-minded about gnomes. In any case, Flick really didn't care to be here at all, and wouldn't have been, except that Shay had not been able to come as he had promised Will he would, and Flick had felt duty-bound to come in his place. Viewed in that perspective, the whole thing was Shay's fault, as Flick had announced to Will 10 seconds after his arrival. After all, if Shay hadn't made his ill-advised promise to visit Will, then Flick would be back in the Vale instead of sitting around in Storlock where he did not want to be in the first place. But Flick was Shay's brother and therefore Will's uncle. Flick refused to think of himself as anyone's granduncle, and since Shay could not come, someone had to make the trip in his stead. The only other someone was Flick. The little guest cottage where Flick was staying came into view, and Will turned reluctantly toward it. He was tired, and he did not feel like an argument, but there would probably be one, because he had spent very little time with Flick during the few days his uncle had been in Storlock, and none at all in the past 36 hours. His work was demanding, but he knew that his uncle viewed that as a lame excuse. He was still mulling the matter over when Flick appeared abruptly on the porch of the cottage, gray-bearded face lapsing into stony disapproval. Resigned to the inevitable, Will mounted the steps and brushed the water from his cloak. Flick studied him wordlessly for a moment, then shook his head. You look exhausted, he declared bluntly. Why aren't you in bed?
Will stared at him.
I'm not in bed because you sent word that you wanted to see me.
Not right away, I didn't.
Well,
Will shrugged helplessly.
I guess I thought I should come to see you now. After all, I haven't been able to give you much time so far.
True enough, his uncle grunted, a hint of satisfaction in his voice at eliciting this admission.
Still, you pick an odd time to mend the error of your ways.
I know you were up all night. I checked. I just wanted to see if you were all right.
I'm fine.
Will managed a brief smile.
You don't look fine. And it's this weather as much as anything.
Flick rubbed his elbows gingerly.
Confounded rain hasn't stopped since I got here. It doesn't bother just old people like me, you know. Bothers everyone, even would-be healers.
He shook his head.
You would be better off back in the Vale.
Will nodded absently. It had been a long time since Shady Vale. For almost 2 years now, he had been living and working in the Village of the Stores, learning the art of healing from the recognized masters of the craft, preparing himself for the time when he might return to the Southland as a healer, to lend the benefit of his skills to his own people. Unfortunately, the whole business of becoming a healer had proven a source of constant irritation to Flick, though Will's grandfather had come to accept it well enough. When the fever had taken Will's parents, a very young Will Ohmsford had bravely resolved that when he grew older, he would become a healer. He had told his grandfather and Flick, in a child's way and with a child's determination, that he wished to save others from sickness and pain. That was fine, they agreed, thinking it a child's whim. But his ambition had stayed with him. And when, on reaching manhood, he announced that it was his intention to study not with the healers of the Southland, whom he knew to be only adequate in their skills, but with the very best healers in the four lands, with the Stores, their attitude had undergone an abrupt change. Good old Uncle Flick had long ago made up his mind about gnomes and the Eastland. Even his grandfather had balked. No Southlander had ever studied with the Stores. How could Will, who did not even speak the language, expect to be taken into their community? But Will had gone despite their reservations, only to be taken before the Store Council upon his arrival and told politely but firmly that no one who was not of the Village of Storlock had ever been permitted to study with them. He might stay as long as he wished, but he could not become one of them. Will did not give up. He decided that he must first learn their language, and he spent almost 2 months doing so. Then he appeared again before the council and again attempted to persuade them, this time speaking to them in their own tongue. He was not successful this time either. Every week for nearly a month after that, he went before the council to plead his cause. He told them everything about himself and his family, everything that had led to his decision to become a healer, everything that he thought might convince them that he should be allowed to study with them. Something must have worked, because finally, without a word of explanation, he was told that he would be permitted to remain and that they would teach him what they knew. In time, if he proved diligent and capable, he would become a healer. He smiled fondly at the memories. How pleased he had been, and his grandfather and Flick, when they had learned of his acceptance, though the latter would never admit it any more than he would admit to the real reason for his disapproval of the whole venture. What really distressed Flick was the distance separating him from Will. He missed the hunting, fishing, and exploring that they had shared while Will was growing up. He missed having Will there in the Vale with him. Flick's wife had died a long time ago, and they had never had any children of their own. Will had been his son.
Flick had always believed that Will would stay on in the Vale and manage the inn with Shay and him. Now Will was gone, settled in Storlock, far from the Vale and his old life, and Will knew that his uncle simply could not accept the way things had worked out. "Are you listening to me?" Flick asked suddenly, a frown creasing his bearded face.
"I'm listening," Will assured him. He placed a hand gently on his uncle's shoulder. "Be patient, Uncle Flick. I'll be back some day. But there is so much to learn yet."
"Well, it's you I'm concerned about, not me," Flick pointed out quickly, his stocky form straightening. "Your grandfather and I can manage just fine without you. But I'm not so sure you can manage without us. Look at you. You push yourself too hard, Will. You have this stubborn streak in you that seems to have blinded you to the fact that you cannot do everything that you might like to do. You are a normal human being like the rest of us. What do I have to do to get you to see that?"
It appeared that he wanted to say more, but with an effort he stopped himself.
"This isn't the time for it." He sighed. His hand came to rest on Will's. "Why don't you go to bed? We can talk when you—"
His gray eyes shifted suddenly, and his voice trailed off. Will turned to follow his gaze. There was movement in the mist, a shadow, dark and solitary. They stared at it curiously, watching it slowly materialize. It became a horse and rider, each blacker than the other. The rider sat bent forward in the saddle as if quite weary from the ride, dark clothing soaked by the rain and plastered against his tall frame. A sudden apprehension stole through Will. This was no store that came. Indeed, this looked to be no man the like of which he had ever seen.
"It cannot be," he heard Flick mutter.
His uncle did not finish the thought. He brushed past Will and stepped to the edge of the porch, bracing himself with an outstretched arm against the rain-slicked railing. Will moved to stand with him. The horseman was coming directly toward them. So strong was the sense of foreboding that the rider's approach engendered within him that the Veilman gave momentary consideration to fleeing. Yet he could not flee. He could only wait, eyes fixed on the spectral form. The rider drew to a halt before the Veilman. His head was lowered, his face hidden within the folds of a dark cowl.
"Hello, Flick."
The rider's voice was a deep, low whisper. Will saw his uncle start.
"Alanon!"
The big man slipped from the back of his horse, but one arm remained hooked about the animal's neck, as if he could not stand alone. Will came forward a pace and stopped. Something was clearly wrong. Alanon's gaze shifted slowly to meet his own.
"Will Ohmsford?"
The Veilman nodded, surprised. "Go quickly and ask the stores to come," he began, then sagged downward, barely catching himself in time to keep from collapsing. Will came down the porch steps instantly, moving to the druid's aid, but stopped as the big man's hand came up in warning.
"Do as I say, Veilman. Go!"
Then Will saw clearly what the rain had hidden from him before. Alanon's clothes were deeply stained with blood. Without another word, the Veilman bounded back up the roadway toward the center, the weariness and discomfort slipping from him like a dream lost in waking.
Chapter 8 The stores took Alanon to the rest center, and although both Will and Flick sought to accompany the injured druid, they were told gently but firmly that their assistance was not needed. Enigmatic and silent, stores and druid disappeared into the corridors of the center, and the Veilmen were left standing in the rain. Since it was apparent that for the moment nothing further would be learned of the druid's coming, Will Ohmsford bade his uncle good night and went off to bed. Later that same day, during the early evening hours, Alanon sent word that he wanted to see both Veilmen.
Will received the news with mixed emotions. On the one hand, he was curious to discover what had befallen the druid. Stories of Al-Anon were familiar territory. His grandfather and Flick had told them all a dozen times over. Yet never in those tales had there been mention of injuries like those the big man had suffered in coming to Storlock. Not even the skull-bearer that had attacked him in the furnace room at Perrinor during the search for the Sword of Shannara had done this kind of damage, and Will wanted to know what manner of creature walked the four lands that was more dangerous than the winged servants of the warlock lord. On the other hand, he was disturbed by the druid's presence in Storlock. It might have been coincidence that Al-Anon came at a time when he found both Flick and Will in the village. It might have been by chance that he stumbled upon them rather than the stores. But Will did not believe it for a moment. Al-Anon had come to them deliberately. Why had he done that, and why had he summoned them to this meeting? Will could understand Al-Anon's wish to confer with Flick. After all, they had met before and shared common adventures. But why Will? The druid didn't even know the youngest Ohmsford. Why would Al-Anon be interested in meeting with him? Nevertheless, he left his quarters and dutifully trooped off through the growing darkness across the village square toward the guest house where he knew Flick would be waiting. Much as he mistrusted the purpose behind this meeting, he was determined to go anyway. He was not one to back away from trouble, and besides, he could be wrong in his suspicions. Perhaps the druid merely wanted to thank him for his help. He found Flick waiting on the porch of the guest cottage, wrapped tightly in his heavy travel cloak, mumbling irritably about the weather. The elder Ohmsford came down the porch steps to join him, and they struck off together down the roadway toward the store rest center. "What do you think he wants, Uncle Flick?" Will asked after a moment, pulling his own cloak closer about him to ward off the evening chill. "Hard to say," Flick grunted. "I'll tell you one thing.